It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
Due to the graphic nature of this killer's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes dramatizations and discussions of murder and assault that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13. Now, enjoy the show.
I was told that Mr. Bundy, the defendant, in representing yourself at this trial, you have a witness to bring to the stand?
Yes, I do. The defense calls Carol Ann Boone to the stand.
What happened next was one of the weirdest occurrences during a major trial in American history.
Carol, do you want to marry me?
Yes.
And I want to marry you?
Yes.
And I do want to marry you.
He said you did.
Hi, I'm Greg Polson, and this is Serial Killers, a new podcast diving into the minds and motives of serial killers. This week, we continue our look into the mind of Ted Bundy, one of the most infamous serial murderers. If you want to listen to any episodes of Serial Killers, you can find them all on your favorite podcast directory. Don't forget to subscribe. You can also listen on our website, parcast.com, spelled parcast.com. A new episode comes out every Monday. Visit our Facebook page, Parcast, to join the conversation. Last week, we tracked Theodore Bundy through a tumultuous childhood that included his mother pretending to be his sister and a possible connection to the disappearance of a young girl. Bundy had raped and killed more than 30 women before the age of 30. He overwhelmingly preferred young, white, brunette women with their hair parted down the middle. This tracks back to his college girlfriend, Diana, who dumped him. Now, for the psychological angle, let's bring back my criminology-obsessed co-host, Vanessa. Vanessa will be answering questions I have about the mental makeup of a serial killer. What makes them tick, what molded them, and what their thought process is like, as well as providing other valuable insight. It's important to note that she's not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but like me, she's fascinated by the psychology of serial killers and has done a lot of research for the show.
Hi, everyone. So last week we dissected very specific aspects about the formation of a serial killer.
Right. What would you say was the most important psychological aspect that we learned about Bundy in our last discussion?
Well, the defining, memorable aspect of Bundy was his charm, his persona. He was smooth.
A real people's person.
You could say that, but this is all born out of his intense need to lie and manipulate. Bundy looked down on everyone around him. His ego compelled him to exercise power at every opportunity.
Does that extend to his killings?
Absolutely. Last week we talked about Bundy's first recorded attack.
You're speaking of Joni Lenz. As we know, it was just past midnight on January 4th, 1974. Bundy had already developed keen stalking and voyeuristic abilities. He sneaked into the young girl's shared home, walked up the stairs, entered her room, and proceeded to beat her with a crowbar and violate her with a bedpost.
Terrifying, but he left her alive.
In a coma, but alive, yes.
Ugh, that means this was a lust attack. He had something pent up in him, and he needed to exercise a certain amount of power over someone or he was going to burst. Ted needed to be in charge.
So how does someone like that get so pent up?
By lying. Ted lied about who he truly was to every single person he interacted with every single day. He lied because he needed to, and because he lied, he killed.
Pop culture has a distinct love affair with serial killers. From serial killers as quasi-lovable heroes in TV shows like Dexter, to collector's cards, to Hitchcock's Psycho. And we can see here, even the police recognize the kind of person Bundy wanted to be projected as.
He was quite taken in by your intelligence, though, and he's a humor.
That's Detective Couch, recalling another member of the force who Bundy had asked about.
Bundy was so incredibly adept and so smart. He knew how far someone can go in this country by just being a nice guy. It's a trait that's very common in psychopaths.
And that's what Bundy was, a psychopath. Not a psychotic?
Correct.
Can you clarify the difference?
Well, unlike Norman Bates, psychopaths are not legally insane. They can differentiate between what is right and what is wrong. Like Bundy, the scariest thing about them is just how normal they can seem. They're charming, well-mannered, and extremely intelligent.
Is there a specific term for this?
Yeah, it's called a mask of sanity, a phrase coined by famous psychologist Hervey Cleckley. These are highly disturbed individuals who completely lack empathy.
But we've seen Bundy in a couple of relationships.
He most likely saw them as a bridge towards sexual fulfillment, if he had any true feelings towards either of them.
Most likely Diane.
Well, if he had any feelings for Diane, his empathetic capacity almost certainly shut all the way down once she dumped him. A process that would have happened even if they'd stayed together and she couldn't fulfill his more extreme psychological needs.
Psychopaths are also incredibly selfish.
Yes. Their needs are always number one. They'd kill to satisfy any urge if need be. This means nothing is off the table once the killing starts. Rape, dismemberment, necrophilia. All dreamed of, all possibly acted upon.
Is a psychotic then not completely aware of their actions?
It's important to understand that psychosis or psychotic disorders cover a wide range of illnesses that are often confused, but for the most part, they involve losing touch with reality. They're often delusional, paranoid, and require medical treatment.
Does a psychotic criminal have empathy?
They very well can, yes. Psychosis isn't someone's fault. It's a disorder, an illness. There's no situational cause, and despite its stigmatization, these people are very capable of empathy.
Ted's soulless activity continued into August 1974. He already killed nearly a dozen women in the Pacific Northwest and was about to take his murderous ways to the Mountain States. He was still dating Liz Clofer at the time, but moved to attend the University of Utah. The relationship continued long distance. So did this separation help or hurt Ted's impulse control?
During this time, he was increasingly compulsive, insatiable, but I don't think that correlated directly with being separated from Liz.
Why not?
Well, because throughout his life, the more Ted killed, the more he seemingly needed to. His entire murderous career was always quickening in pace.
As supported by the fact that within a month of his move to Utah in September of 1974, a new string of murders began. Vanessa, you mentioned that this was a compulsive act, that he had a hunger that needed to be filled, an addiction of sorts. Was there ever any sign of Bundy trying to stop himself from killing more?
There was.
Is that common?
Well, most serial killers struggle at times, yes. Being as smart and survival-based as they are, many would recognize that they wouldn't be able to kill without getting caught forever.
But
their need and ego almost always wins.
I'm sorry, can I help you, sir?
Hi, what's your name?
I'm not supposed to talk to strangers.
Well, my name's Ted. There, we're not strangers no more.
I'm Nancy.
Hi, Nancy. I like your hoop earrings.
You do?
Mm-hmm.
You a college boy? I'm not supposed to talk to no college boys.
Oh, that's cute. I'm gonna need you to get in the car.
What?
Get in the car, Nancy.
I don't...
Don't make this hard, Nancy.
October 2nd, 1974, Bundy kidnapped Nancy Wilcox, a 16-year-old resident of Salt Lake City. And dragged her into a nearby orchard. He raped her multiple times. His intention was to, quote-unquote, de-escalate his urges, a purging of sorts. He claimed that he had every intention of releasing her once his thirst had been quenched. But that's not what happened. Bundy later confessed.
And she was ushered into there and restrained and then placed in the car and taken to the apartment.
The park?
The apartment.
Oh, apartment. Now, at what point would she have been killed? In the orchard or at your apartment?
The next day.
Now, we're talking about the same apartment, though?
Yes.
In that apartment, Bundy strangled the young girl in an attempt to suppress her screams. Her remains were never found. Vanessa?
Yes?
This one puzzles me. It feels like this is Bundy showing a crack in the wall. Showing that he possibly regretted killing women, or that he didn't want to continue, despite himself.
That's a fair interpretation, but if you look at what we know about Bundy, that doesn't quite add up. Bundy killed often, more than 30 women over 5 years. Someone like that doesn't just grow a heart one day. A hesitation doesn't constitute a conscience.
This isn't Whoville.
Most definitely not. As I mentioned before, this lifestyle cannot be maintained for a long period of time. The longest operating serial killers in the world lasted so long because of how infrequently they killed.
Bundy knew this was unsustainable.
Right, but he continued.
As evidenced by the fact that 16 days later, he had already found a new victim. Melissa Ann Smith, the 17-year-old daughter of a police chief. And then just another 2 weeks after that, on Halloween 1974, Bundy kidnapped Laura Ann Aim. Does the similarity in name mean anything?
Normally, I may say yes, but Bundy rarely knew the names of his victims beforehand. He would stalk and take advantage of those alone, often late at night in parking lots.
He was an opportunist then.
That's exactly right. Bundy had a certain amount of pride for how much skill it took to do what he did. Daylight abductions, crowded areas. But the truth of the matter is that the majority of his victims were just people in the wrong place at the right time.
What makes less sense, though, are the rituals that the bodies of Melissa and Laura revealed. Both of these women were found beaten, raped, sodomized, and strangled, naked and dead in the mountains. But it was during a late confessional that Bundy revealed that he had a post-mortem ritual with his victims.
Sir, over here!
What is it?
The Smith girl from Midvale.
Oh, Lord have mercy.
How long do you think she's been out here?
I don't know. Day? Maybe two?
Why is her hair so clean?
And her makeup so fresh.
I've never seen nothing like this, sir.
Neither have I.
Bundy often shampooed his victims' hair and applied makeup to their faces.
This is completely demented. This goes into a very, very dark side of Bundy.
Darker than serial murder.
Afraid so. This was not a masculinity thing. This was not Bundy being a clean freak. This was Bundy maintaining control and ensuring that he could have a viable sex object for as long as possible.
Oh.
Yes. Bundy, similar to serial killer Edmund Kemper, would keep the dead bodies of his victims for days, sometimes weeks, so that he could engage with their bodies.
Now that's a lot to digest. The idea that Bundy hinted at being able to sleep with his dead victims may have been more satisfying than actually killing them is incredibly loaded. Is it still just a power trip for him?
I believe so, yes. He wanted to repeatedly overpower and dominate. Killing someone is a singular act. You can't kill someone and then kill them again. You kill them and then have to find someone else. Whereas beating, bludgeoning, raping, and continuing to defile past their expiration are all repeatable. All of these were very ingrained as Bundy's M.O.
And this developed very quickly. Bundy's first reported attack was January 1974, and we're talking about the next November. Bundy would continue to kill for another 4 years.
We'll return to our story in just a moment.
And now, back to serial killers.
Can I help you?
Hello, miss. My name is Officer Roseland of the Murray Police Department.
It was November 8th, 1974, and Bundy was impersonating an officer.
Is everything okay?
Is your license K8DL32?
Yes.
I'm sorry to inform you, but we caught someone attempting to break into your car.
Oh, no.
I'll need you to come down to the station with me. We're holding the man in custody. Can I confirm your name, please?
I'm Carol DeRanch.
I'm real sorry about all this.
It happens, I guess.
Bundy immediately pulled out a pair of handcuffs and attempted to restrain DeRanch. He successfully fastened both handcuffs onto the same wrist. DeRanch kicked the door open and successfully escaped. DeRanch later described seeing him in court. She said that no matter how he aged, his eyes stayed the same. I quote, cold, just no expression in him, no feeling to him, unquote. Undeterred by DeRanch's bravery, Bundy claimed another victim later that same day. The string of disappearing women led to a massive manhunt. The best lead the police had came thanks to 8 female witnesses who described encountering Bundy in the summer of 1974.
He introduced himself as Ted. He wanted us to help him move his sailboat from his car. We all said no except for
me. I went over with him and he was still polite. But we got to his car and it was a bug. Blue or brown, I don't remember. But it didn't have a sailboat. So I ran.
We later saw him go up to that Janice girl, the one on the news, and we knew we had to say something.
What ultimately narrowed down the suspects was a compilation of every acquaintance and fellow student of each and every victim. 26 Teds showed up on 4 lists. Bundy was one of them. And there was one more aspect keying their attention to Bundy. Bundy's own girlfriend, Liz Clofer, called the police after she noticed girls were disappearing in Bundy's area. She made the decision without talking to Bundy. According to those close to the case, Bundy was literally at the top of the pile of suspects when word came from Utah that he'd been arrested.
We have a tan Volkswagen Bug just sped through traffic stop. Need assistance.
This is 612. Just had eyes on it.
Bundy was spotted by Sergeant Bob Hayward, parked in a home's driveway. A home whose owners the sergeant knew to be on vacation. When his headlights hit Bundy's car, Bundy sped off, eventually pulling over at a gas station.
Put your hands in the air!
Ted was under arrest. The sergeant quickly searched Ted's car. In the trunk, he found pantyhose, a ski mask, a crowbar, an ice pick, and handcuffs. Hayward would describe his feelings about the situation in a 2000 interview.
I didn't want to shoot the guy. I wish I had.
Police quickly searched Bundy's apartment. More items like the ones in his trunk, as well as a map of ski mountains with X's on them, were found. But nothing incriminating enough to keep him. Bundy was released and placed on 24-hour surveillance by the Salt Lake City Police. But it wasn't long before Bundy made his first big mistake. Bundy sold his VW Bug to a young man.
He was trying to get rid of any connection to his past.
But since Bundy was under 24-hour surveillance, that car was quickly seized. Upon searching the car, hair strands from 3 murder victims who had no connection to each other were found. An occurrence that one FBI worker said would be a coincidence of mind-boggling rarity. The police quickly arrested Bundy. They threw him in a lineup in front of Carol DeRanch, his escape victim. She immediately identified him. And, for the second time, it looked like Bundy was done for. Bundy was briefly let out on bail, a time during which Liz continued her relationship with him. Of that time, she said,
"When Ted and I stepped out on the porch to go somewhere, so many unmarked police cars started up that it sounded like the beginning of the Indy 500.
Now, Vanessa, there's a lot going on.
You don't say.
So we've established that Bundy is a smart fellow.
Yeah, very.
But he just almost been caught, literally jailed. In this time, do you think he considered killing again?
Absolutely. Killing was a necessity for him. To have both his freedom and criminal activity restrained caused him immense distress.
And this whole time, Liz, his girlfriend, had been talking to the police. She shared stories about his time away from her, weird items in his apartment, Why did she remain with him?
Well, the psyche of any party involved with an abusive relationship is incredibly complicated and beyond logic. From what I can tell, this relationship lasted so long because it's what she knew. Ted being Ted most likely gaslighted her into thinking that if he ever lashed out at her, it was her fault.
Gaslighted?
Gaslighting is a psychological means that an abusive person uses to make another person question their own sanity. It's always the other person's fault. If they question something, they're not going to look at it the right way. It's incredibly damaging.
Could you tell our audience why it's called gaslighting?
The name comes from a play, more famous for its adaptation into a Hitchcock film called Gaslight. In Gaslight, a man manipulates his wife into believing she's insane so that she won't report his criminal activity, because, as he insists to her throughout the play, the crimes aren't happening.
Even though they are.
Yes.
Just like Bundy and Liz.
Exactly. When being gaslighted, everything from the victim's memory to their mental state will be questioned and trivialized. So if Liz tried to call Ted out for acting weird, Ted would twist her words. She was acting weird. She wasn't being open. She didn't remember the event correctly.
And Liz stayed with him, even though she'd been in touch with the Utah police for some time now.
This time of her life was probably intensely difficult. She had no doubt realized that Ted was not the person she thought he was. Beyond the abuse, she most likely knew he had killed at some point, which means she was either remaining with him for the sake of the police, or...
To willingly live with someone you know is so dangerous.
Or she was just about the most loyal person in Bundy's life, torn and tragic.
We'll return to our story in just a moment from the Parcast Network.
And now back to the story.
On February 23rd, 1976, Bundy stood trial for his attempted kidnapping of Carol Durant. Bundy was sentenced to 1 to 15 years in the Utah State Prison. Then things started to get really wild. On June 7th, 1977, Bundy was transferred to an Aspen jail for a preliminary hearing. Having been to law school...
And having such a penchant for control.
Bundy elected to be his own counsel. As such, Bundy was freed of his shackles for the hearing. During a recess, Bundy requested he be allowed to visit the courthouse law library, presumably to brush up on, well... law. It was here that Bundy made his first escape from custody. Hidden behind a bookcase, Bundy opened a window and jumped from the second story. He sprained his ankle and ran. Bundy spent the next 6 days breaking into multiple homes, wandering the woods, and eventually stealing a car.
I was disoriented and you know, quite frankly, I hopped in a car and just drove. I knew I'd get caught. I mean, I didn't want to get caught, but I knew it would happen, but I was just so tired. And I just said, well, let's just see what happens. And a fluke, actually, they stopped me. But, you know, anyway, that was one of the more profound experiences of being over here. Yeah. Certainly did cause a furor.
Bundy was in custody once again. With this arrest, Liz Clofer finally ended her relationship with Bundy.
Good for her. Though it's crazy it took Bundy breaking out of jail for her to get to that point.
Breaking out of jail is, may I say, reckless? What kind of person does it take to attempt an escape from jail?
Someone with extreme self-confidence. The amount of ego it takes to think that they'll be successful is massive, at least for someone like Ted.
You can hear him sort of playing it casual in that interview.
Bundy was very good at that. He'd do his very best not to get caught. But once he was, it was no big deal. Ted and people like Ted are remarkably calm under pressure.
Not to mention, as has been said about the victims he chose, he's nothing if not an opportunist.
Precisely. If Ted sees a chance, he'll take it.
And the crazy thing is, when he was caught, he started to win his trial. Key pieces of evidence became inadmissible, and a few judge decisions fell in his favor. With the victory, all Ted had to do was serve out the year and a half left on the Durant conviction, and he'd be a free man.
But the Ted we know can't just sit still.
And he didn't. Instead, he concocted a second, more complex escape plan involving a hacksaw blade, $500 in cash, and a detailed floor plan of the jail. While other inmates showered, Ted began to saw a hole in the ceiling. He purposely lost 35 pounds while detained, just enough to slip through into the room above. Bundy changed clothes, stole a car, and escaped from prison for a second time within a year. But instead of the woods, this time Bundy was headed to Florida. The time he would spend there would be full of his most heinous, despicable acts. Violations that even he refused to recount in future confessions. To our new listeners, this section of the podcast goes into detail on some of the most horrific actions committed by man against man. If summaries of incredibly graphic and disturbing assaults and murders may upset you, feel free to skip ahead or look out for our episode recap. Vegas, 2:45 a.m., January 15th, 1978. Florida State University. Bundy entered the unlocked back door of sorority house Chi Omega. Over the next 15 minutes, he attacked four young women, Margaret Bowman, Lisa Levy, Kathy Kleiner, and Karen Chandler. Two of them did not survive. Then he broke into an apartment building eight blocks away and attacked another FSU student, Cheryl Thomas, dislocating her shoulder and breaking her jaw and skull. Damage that would end Thomas's promising dance career. The series of bludgeons, assaults, and deranged sexual perversions shook the area to its core. Vanessa, what do you think was behind Ted's increased aggression?
Well, it had been a long, long time since Bundy had killed. He'd gotten into the rhythm of attacking almost two people a month, to now have gone months and months without any sort of outlet.
The balloon
exploded. It was very ugly, and I think Ted seeing what jail was like and what was most likely in store for him turned him uglier, more perverse.
That perversion claimed one more tragic victim. On February 8, 1978, 90 miles from the Chi Omega attack, Bundy approached 12-year-old Kimberly Diane Leach at Lake City Junior High School. Her mummified remains were found 7 weeks later at a pig farm. Thankfully, Bundy's new reign of terror did not last long. He was caught, once again, with a stolen car. Bundy was back in custody, this time for good. But with the start of Bundy's new trial came a weird new phenomenon, fan mail. Letter after letter of fan mail came in from women all over the country. Vanessa, please, please help me to understand the wild idea of what can only be described as serial killer groupies.
Okay, think of it as a more messed up version of the typical good girl, bad guy daydream.
You're not comparing Ted Bundy to James Dean, are you?
Not directly, but Bundy was a star and gave off the vibe that he was innocent. That little slip of doubt he put out into the world was latched onto by a very specific type of woman. But this isn't a new concept.
So what, a killer in the 40s had some fans?
Try 1895, when during the trial of San Francisco's sex killer Theo Durant, a young woman named Rosalind Bowflowers presented the convict with a bouquet of flowers.
Were Bundy's admirers mostly on the sidelines?
Some were content to just be pen pals, but one couldn't help but to pursue a relationship.
This one I know. Remember how we started the show?
Carol, do you want to marry me?
Yes.
And I want to marry you?
Yes.
And I do want to marry
you. He said you did.
That's Bundy taking advantage of an old Floridian law in order to marry admirer and girlfriend Carol Ann Boone during his trial. How can someone be okay openly engaging with this sort of man? At this point of the trial, it was irrefutable that Bundy had killed viciously.
I think at the heart of the Carol Ann-Ted Bundy relationship is a sort of Beauty and the Beast fantasy.
Somehow, I don't think Bundy is royalty.
No, but in this woman's thoughts, their love could be so big and so powerful that it could transform this monster into a decent human being.
Oh boy.
You sound surprised, but this is just the basis of relationships all over the world, just on a smaller scale. The messy guy who just needs some guidance.
And to not kill.
Exactly.
And if that wasn't an option?
Well, if she had no pretense that she could change his behavior at all, then she most likely had a deep sense of self-hatred.
She may have thought she was so worthless that this horrible, despicable human was the only kind of person who could possibly love her.
Bingo.
Neither of those relationships sound very healthy.
Nor will a tryst with a serial killer ever be.
Thankfully, it was not a relationship that lasted very long. After a long, tumultuous, media frenzy-filled trial, Ted Bundy was sentenced to death by electric chair for the murder of more than 30 women. News reports on the event characterized Bundy as, quote, an articulate, intelligent, 42-year-old man, a former Boy Scout, law student, and Republican Party activist. He also is the subject of 5 books and a television movie, and the object of widespread loathing. Till the bitter end, the media could not help but frame Bundy in an intelligent, almost flattering light.
More importantly, at the very end, we heard Ted in one of his last confessions referring to himself in the third person.
He placed his hands around her throat just to throttle her into unconsciousness so that she wouldn't scream anymore. And then, let's say, he removed her clothes and raped her.
Was he going psychotic?
I'm skeptical, but I think there's little doubt that the years of violence and mental strain had broken him. He was full of himself, yet softer at the same time.
But no matter how crazy or deep in his run, Bundy's MO had never wavered. He was the same killer from start to finish. He was a deeply disturbed individual who fantasized intensely about violent behavior and subsequently acted on those fantasies in ways that would leave behind a generation in terror. And in a pre-OJ world, his trial and status as a celebrity elevated him to a household name. Something that may never have happened if he'd been a bit more careful with his stolen cars. Here's his court statement upon being sentenced to the death penalty.
I'm not asking for mercy, for I find it somewhat absurd to ask for mercy for something I did not do. So I will be tortured for and will suffer for and receive the pain for that act. But I will not share the burden for the guilt.
Bundy elevated what people thought was possible for what one human could inflict upon another. His psychopathic behavior and preference for young girls will forever cement him as one of the worst criminals and murderers in American history. For all the surviving victims and family of victims, we can only hope for peace. Thank you for listening to Serial Killers. Be sure to join us next Monday as we start investigating the psychological profile of the Axeman of New Orleans. If you enjoy this episode, please tell your friends. Don't forget to subscribe to Serial Killers on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or any other podcast directory, or through our website, parcast.com. That's parcast.com. A new episode of Serial Killers comes out every Monday. Please let us know what you think and join the conversation on our Parcast Facebook page. You can tweet us at Parcast Network. That's PARCAST Network. Have a killer week. Serial Killers was created by Max Cutler and developed by Ron Cutler. It is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It's produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Joel Stein and Maggie Admire. Serial Killers is written by Patrick R. Young and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson. The amazing cast of voice actors includes, by alphabetical order, Jerry Courtney Alstein, Mike Capozzi, Nicholas Massu, and Stephen Pinto.